This is Endocrine Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Welcome again to Endocrine Feedback Loop for our 11th episode. Today, we look at an article from the JCENM that informs our understanding of the natural history of cystic fibrosis-related diabetes. Knowing more about that process will improve the care we provide to our patients with CFRD. Thinking about the inferential methods employed in this study will help us appreciate the strengths and weaknesses of this report. As a reminder, I am a general endocrinologist at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee, where I also serve as one of the directors for our fellowship program. As usual, for the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast, two excellent endocrinologists join me to help analyze today's article. First, I welcome Rich Comey back into our virtual recording studio as our regular contributor for this episode. Rich comes to us from the Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center in New Hampshire, where he has been the director of the fellowship program for many years. He is a general endocrinologist as well, but has a particular interest in CFRD, working in Dartmouth's well-known Cystic Fibrosis Center. Second, our guest expert today is Kim Donahue from the University of Sydney in Australia. She is one of the world's experts in diabetes and its complications in childhood, with extensive research and numerous publications in this field. She helps lead the Institute of Endocrinology and Diabetes in Sydney and works at the Children's Hospital at Westmead. So we have a great group for our discussion today. As always, everything we discuss is our opinions only and not of our respective institutions or of the Endocrine Society. Today's article is Glucose Tolerance Stages in Cystic Fibrosis Are Identified by a Unique Pattern of Defects of Beta Cell Function, and is a forthcoming article from the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. The first author is Claudia Piona, with this work coming to us from the universities of Verona, Naples, and Parma in Italy. Rich, I'll now turn things over to you for you to give us an overview of the key points the authors make in addition to leading our conversation about CFRD in general. Rich?
Thank you, Chase. So this paper is really a pathophysiology analysis paper to sort of learn more about cystic fibrosis-related diabetes. Cystic fibrosis-related diabetes is a significant medical problem. It's one that's associated with worse respiratory and weight outcomes in patients with cystic fibrosis. And treatment of this does ameliorate those deleterious health effects. So it's an important health issue. The current model for the development of cystic fibrosis-related diabetes in cystic fibrosis is that normal glucose tolerance, which is a normal fasting glucose and a glucose less than 140 after a load of glucose up to 75 grams, will then progress to impaired glucose tolerance, where the post-glucose challenge will be over 140 at the two-hour time point, and then onto impaired fasting glucose tolerance, and finally onto cystic fibrosis-related diabetes, meeting the classic criteria of a two-hour post-challenge glucose greater than 200. Other groups have classified cystic fibrosis-related diabetes by the presence or absence of hyperglycemia, but this paper is going to concentrate solely on glucose tolerance in the oral glucose tolerance test. There are other intermediate stages that have been talked about in this disease that can be identified on a glucose tolerance test. One of the other stages is the indeterminate stage, in which the individual has a normal fasting glucose. During the test, between the 0 and 2 hour time point, the blood glucose rises above 200, but then falls back below 140 at the 2 hour time point. Other groups have noted abnormal glucose tolerance 140, which is similar in that there's a normal fasting glucose, the blood glucose rises above 140, but not above 200 in the intermediate time points, and then falls back at 2 hours to less than 140. So there are other intermediate steps that have been identified in the past, and the mechanisms by which cystic fibrosis-related diabetes are not really fully understood. It's unclear what the contributions are of various hormones, but in this paper, the authors are going to concentrate on the contributions of insulin insufficiency, insulin resistance, and insulin clearance at these time points to see if they can characterize how this problem develops over a spectrum. So the study goal is really to assess the order of severity of the defects of glucose tolerance, looking specifically at the three direct determinants of glucose regulation. And that sort of describes what their intention is.
And Kim, so before we move on to looking at the methods, we had several questions for you that we were hoping that you could help us understand. So first one, Rich mentioned early on that there can be a description when we talk about the development of CFRD as to whether there's fasting hyperglycemia present. Some groups make a big deal about that. Some seem to say that that's not particularly important. Can you give us an understanding, at least from your perspective, if that distinction is important, particularly since it's really not a major component of this study? Is that something that was an oversight or is maybe not that big a deal?
I don't think it's that big a deal. Patients with CFRD are often subcategorized by the absence or presence of fasting hyperglycemia because this fasting hyperglycemia is considered to represent a more advanced stage of disease and has been associated with microvascular complications. And that goes back to 2010. But really, we're moving far more to treating earlier so that whether or not the patient has fasting hyperglycemia probably doesn't come into that treatment decision at all now.
Good, that's helpful. So then my second question, and Rich kind of mentioned the idea of some of these intermediate stages, and we're going to hit this again because, well, when you start defining more and more stages, it can be really hard to keep track of all of them. So we're going to take several passes at going through all of these stages. But before we go through the actual details of that and the methods and, again, and the results, Kim, another question for you. Is this idea of stages that there's a gradual progression, can you give us an overview? Is there fairly good support for this pathophysiologic progression and a general consensus that this is how the stages move along, or are there a variety of ideas about how CFRD may ultimately develop?
Well, it's certainly true to say that the pre-diabetes, before you get the elevated post-glucose challenge at 120 minutes, there are certainly abnormalities. And I think we're understanding far more about how that can impact on the clinical progress of the patients themselves. And there are pathological studies that do show that the pancreas is deteriorating, that the beta cells the islets are being blocked. But it may also be that the actual genetic problem that causes the diabetes, that the genes are also expressed in the beta cells, and it may be that even before there's any obliteration of the islets, that the islets can't respond as well to glucose, so that there's an actual insulin defect that's developing very early on. And I think this paper certainly supports that.
Yeah, so we'll certainly look at that in a lot more detail, and I do think that does help answer that question a little bit. And so one final question then for you, Kim, and you've hinted at some of this already, but give us an understanding of why this distinction is important. So they look at these three components. Rich mentioned them already. They look at insulin insufficiency, but also resistance and clearance. Is there really an importance in understanding these differences? Is it just an academic question that they're answering, or is there real clinical implications to understanding this process?
I don't think we know the full answer to that, but we know there is a spectrum of disease within completely normal glucose tolerance and between the diabetes. And we're talking about clinical deteriorations in lung function and deteriorations in nutrition.
Good. So I think we have a nice overview of things. Rich has really walked us through this paper in particular, what the points the authors make and the questions that they're trying to get answered. And then Kim's done a good job of helping us understand the landscape a little bit more. So now what we're going to do is take a closer look at the methodology here. And as usual, take our initial step back and think about the study design that's used. And the authors here use a cross-sectional study design. We've looked at cross-sectional studies before, but as a quick reminder of how cross-sectional studies work, the key idea of this study design is that all of the data is collected at a single point in time. This is in contrast to a different type of observational study, a cohort study, where there is a time component. That initially with cohort studies, you split your subjects into at least two groups, sometimes multiple, based on the presence or absence of an exposure. And then you follow them over time to see if one group develops an outcome more frequently than the other groups do. This is different with a cross-sectional because there isn't that time component. So you collect all of your data at once. You still split individuals into groups based on the idea of exposure and looking for an outcome, but it can be a lot trickier because, as opposed to a cohort study where you can make sure that your subjects haven't already developed the outcome, you don't have that luxury with a cross-sectional study. You get all of your data at once, and so you're collecting all of your information about exposure and all of your information about outcomes at a single point in time. And so it can sometimes be a little bit tricky to really clearly make that connection between exposure and outcome, given how you've collected your data. So that's a one important thing to think about with cross-sectional studies. Another important aspect, and it is also linked to that lack of a time component, is that it's really hard to provide a natural history. With cohort studies or any other sort of study with a time component, you can make sure that a subject does not have something at one stage and then follow these subjects and see how they develop problems over time. Again, with cross-sectional studies, because you don't have a time component, it's really hard to say this is how things naturally unfold. The authors here suggest that there are stages, and as we will look at, they're going to put the subject into different stages, but it's very hard to prove that one stage naturally progresses to another just with a cross-sectional study. Often you can have other studies that inform that, but in and of itself, that is a limitation that we need to be thinking about. And finally, one other point that I think is worth remembering that's relevant for the study that we're going to look at today is that prevalence is usually something that you can determine with a cross-sectional study, but depending upon how you select your subjects, there are some limitations. Normally, cross-sectional studies are great for figuring out a prevalence, how many individuals in your group of patients have a condition whenever you collect that sample. However, we do need to remember that if this is not a truly random selection of individuals, that it may not really give you a true prevalence. And so we're going to think about that. We're going to come back to all of these things as we talk about this paper, because I think it makes a little bit more sense as we look at the methods employed here, then we can understand exactly how those limitations come in. So we're going to think about that as we go along. So now let's go back to this paper and look at the methods here. So as we think about the subjects that are in this study. So they had 232 subjects, children through young adults, and this was done at two centers in Italy. And there were several inclusion criteria that were used. So more specifically about the ages, all of the subjects in this study had to be between the ages of 10 and 25 years. And as far as having cystic fibrosis, they all had to have a confirmed diagnosis based on genetic testing and sweat testing. And then finally, they had to have treated exocrine dysfunction to be included here. So I think relatively straightforward standard inclusion criteria. Where we do need to think a little bit more, though, as we move on to the exclusion criteria. And the first one, I think this is really important, is that an exclusion criteria was that if you already carried a diagnosis of CFRD or you were already on insulin. And I think this goes back to the idea of understanding exactly what your sample is and who's been excluded here. I don't have any problem with the exclusion. I think they probably appropriately excluded individuals who had already been diagnosed with CFRD or on insulin. And I would certainly welcome Kim or Rich to have other ideas about that. But I think that absolutely makes sense because that's not what they wanted to study. They're looking at a natural history before treatment gets started. However, the implication of excluding those individuals is that you're going to take out a lot, probably most, if not all, actually, individuals with symptomatic CFRD. So this isn't truly a random sample of where you're taking all individuals. You're taking all of those out who have worse disease because almost always they would have been diagnosed already because they're presenting to providers with symptoms. And so that's leading to a diagnosis of CFRD. So those individuals would not be included here. Potentially, you're also having problems if maybe you've got individuals who are, say, more engaged in the healthcare system, then they're maybe getting tested more frequently and they might have already been diagnosed as well. So there's at least a couple of different groups of individuals that probably wouldn't have been included in this study because of the exclusion of those who already carried a diagnosis of CFRD. A few other exclusion criteria that were used here. as far as recent infections, antibiotics, and steroids, those were all exclusion. If you were treated with a CFTR modulator, that was an exclusion criteria. And then finally, if you had liver disease or had a liver or a lung transplantation, those were all exclusion criteria that were used here. So before we actually look at how this data was collected, just thinking about inclusion and exclusion criteria, Kim and Rich, any comments on those things, any concerns, or feel like this is a fairly good group to try to answer the question that the authors are posing here?
I'll defer to Kim, who I think is much more of an expert. In our CFRD center, people who would have met these criteria would have been generally healthier than the average patient, meaning that they had not been ill enough, weight loss, et cetera, usually prompted a lot more testing and a lot of these other things. So I would have thought this was a relatively healthier population.
Yes, they would be healthier. Though I guess we often get asked, please, can you treat this patient with insulin because they're not gaining weight? So there is that group even before they clearly have diabetes where they had clinical problems. But I guess those ones weren't included. So I think they're good exclusion criterion that they've used. A number of the formulae would have been difficult to use because they needed insulin. If they're actually taking insulin, the levels of insulin would be hard to interpret. They would have had to change their formula to use C-peptide.
Yeah, I agree. So I think it was an appropriate exclusion. But again, we've got to remember, just like Rich said, they're taking out a bunch of folks who are going to be sicker, either based on weight loss issues, and that's why insulin got started, like Kim suggested, or people who had diabetes itself, and that's how they got diagnosed. Good. All right. So now we're going to get into the weeds here on actual how these folks were put into different stages. There are multiple stages, which can be a little bit hard to keep track of because often there's only a single point difference in data that would put you into one stage versus another. So we're going to take a few passes at this. I'm going to give you an initial description of that, and then Rich will walk us through the results here shortly, and he'll go through all these again just to make sure that we're on the same page. So first, before we do that, just a word about the OGTT. Rich mentioned some details about that already, but the way this was done, 8 o'clock in the morning after an overnight fast, and the glucose load was 1.75 grams per kilogram, but that had a maximum of 75 grams of glucose. And then the stages that were determined after that glucose load, so five different stages. So we're going to walk through those one at a time. So initially, so the first stage is completely normal. So that is multiple points. So the two that we always think of, so you had to have a normal fasting glucose, so 126 or lower, and then also that 2 hour glucose had to be under 140. But additionally, because we're really looking at intermediate stages here, the mid stage as well in between those two points had to be below 140. So you had to have all of those to be normal. And then the first of the intermediate stages that the authors are interested here, they describe as an AGT 140. So abnormal glucose tolerance 140. So the two endpoints, they were the same. So the fasting one was also similar. So that had to be under 126. And then the 2 hour also had to be under 140. But the midpoint's the distinction there. So with the AGT 140 is between these two points, you got up to 140 or above. You didn't get above 200, but you did have a modest spike before going back under 140 at the 2 hour mark. The next stage is just slightly worse. So this is what they describe as indeterminate. So again, fasting had to be normal, 126 or under. The 2 hour also had to be normal, under 140. But that midpoint spike was a little bit worse. So you got all the way to 200 or above with that. So AGT 140, you got up to 140 to 200. The indeterminate, you got up to 200 or above. And then the next stage, a little bit more recognizable based on other more longstanding definitions, was impaired. And so that one is just based on the 2 hour time point where you get to 140 or above, but not above 200. And then the final, that fifth stage, is diabetes. So here, cystic fibrosis related diabetes. And that's where the 2 hour point, you were at 200 or above. So these five stages progressing from normal to AGT 140 to indeterminate to impaired to diabetes, these five stages. Again, we'll actually look at that, keeping in mind limitations about how well cross-sectional studies can really show that progression, but it's at least defined in a way that would make you think of that initially. All right. So a little bit more information about calculations that the authors do, some modeling. And this is all related to insulin levels that are drawn and how they understand insulin metabolism. So the first thing is thinking about beta cell function. And the authors use two different ways of understanding beta cell function. And the first one is they describe as a derivative control. And that is thinking about the response to rise in glucose. This is also described as first phase insulin secretion. So the delta, seeing how that affects insulin. And then the second one, again, looking at beta cell function, is the proportional control. So this isn't looking at the delta. This is just looking at the static concentration. And this would be the second phase insulin secretion. So two different ways of understanding beta cell function, derivative control and proportional control. Two other aspects of insulin metabolism. So one would be the insulin clearance. And then the other one would be insulin sensitivity. So specifically here, the method that they use is the oral glucose sensitivity index, though they mentioned that there are quite a few that were available that they could have chosen from. So Kim, wanted to get your insight into this a little bit. So give us a little bit of a sense of all of these different methods, but also particularly that last one when they're thinking about insulin sensitivity. They chose the oral glucose sensitivity index, but there were lots of other ones that they could have chosen. So how standard are these approach? Is this fairly agreed upon that these different models of function are the way to do it, or are there other ways that it could be considered?
Well, the gold standard for measuring insulin sensitivity, of course, is the hyperinsulinemic euglycemic clamp, which has been around since DeFronzo described it in 1971. And that's the insulin's infused at a suprabasal rate to suppress the endogenous insulin production, and the rate of glucose infusion is then measured to maintain the euglycemia. And that's considered the insulin sensitivity. And that's really the gold standard. And then a number of other ways of looking at insulin sensitivity have been used, and they can be based on just the fasting measures, or they can be based on measures during the oral glucose tolerance test. And then some have used a combination of the oral glucose tolerance and an IV, an intravenous glucose tolerance test. So this index that they're using was described in 2001, and indeed it already has 803 citations. So whilst it's not the gold standard, it's been around for a while, and it's probably equivalent to many. The problem is that most of the indices have been compared to this gold standard, the clamp, in type 2 diabetes and obese patients. And we don't really have any other data using clamps in cystic fibrosis to know, or thinner people, to know what it actually means and which is the best one. So the one they're using uses insulin and glucose at the 0, 120 and 90 minute. Others use different time points along that scale, and there are some that use C-peptide as well. So I think it's as good as any, and they in fact do use four others, which are in the supplement.
Good. And I think in particular that point that you made about we don't necessarily know how well this works in CFRD is a good one. Rich had raised that initially when we did our analysis of this article as a question that he had. So we'll come back to that at the end as we think about conclusions there and how that might impact things. But I think that's definitely a good point there. So now we're going to move on to the actual results now that we've understood the methods and exactly how this study was carried out. So Rich, why don't you walk us through some of the results that the authors found, and then we'll chime in along the way with some of our questions that we had about those findings in particular.
So their initial results were just basically a description of the patients that they had in their population. So about 53% of the patients were male. So actually they had a reasonable male-female distribution. And the average body mass index was 19.6, which is very typical for cystic fibrosis patients. They were not grossly underweight, at least for this study. They looked at the distribution of glucose tolerance in this group. Again, this is a group who does not have a previous diagnosis of cystic fibrosis-related diabetes. And interestingly, only 22% of them were actually normal by the oral glucose tolerance test. And that again, it goes along with the prevalence of disordered glucose metabolism in cystic fibrosis. that initial stage, the AGT-140, where they had a mid-test glucose greater than 140, 37% of the patients were in that group. The indeterminate group, where they had a mid-test glucose greater than 200, only 8% were in that group, so that was the smallest group. In classic impaired glucose tolerance, it was 21%. And then true cystic fibrosis-related diabetes, meaning they had a blood sugar over 200 at the two-hour time point, was 12%. So they actually had somebody or a small number in each of the categories, and actually an interestingly reasonable distribution throughout those. But again, I think the most striking thing on that was that only 22% of these individuals were actually normal. They didn't see any differences across these groups in age, body mass index, gender, or the genotypes. So they didn't see any other characteristics that might have led to this. The hemoglobin A1C values were typical, which is that in the normal group, the hemoglobin A1C was normal at 5.6%. And that rose gradually up to 6.1% in the patients who had true CFRD. And that's very characteristic of patients with CFRD, is that the hemoglobin A1C is not these numbers we see in type 1 and type 2 diabetes of 8 or 9%. We tend to see this. But they definitely did see the hemoglobin A1C, which as an estimate of the average glucose for a period of time, rise slowly through these groups.
And Rich, a couple different questions that I had related to that. So the first one actually, I think, was your point about saying that in these different stages that they didn't see a difference in age and BMI and gender and genotype. And one thing I thought that jumped out to me back on that point is that in particular, that there's not a difference in BMI could easily reflect that exclusion criteria that we talked about before. Is that if you had included all comers, including those who were sick and had really bad CFRD, that probably would not be the case. And so I think to take a step back and say, how could you take a misstep here? The authors don't do this, but I think if you're not careful and you're just reading this, how could you come to an erroneous conclusion? You could say, well, I've always heard that CFRD is really bad. Rich mentioned that as one of the first points that he made, is that it's really bad for your health, in particular as related to weight loss and all the bad outcomes that come in cystic fibrosis with that. And then an erroneous conclusion would be to say, well, they didn't see a difference in BMI in any of these groups, so maybe that's not really that big a deal, particularly in CFRD. And I think that's where it would be really important to understand, yes, but they excluded everybody who carried a diagnosis or were on insulin. So if there were folks who were already struggling with weight, even if they were at an intermediate stage, which Kim suggested, and got put on insulin for that reason, they excluded those people. But then also they excluded people who carried a diagnosis. So these may have been people who were tested and found to have diabetes because they were having trouble maintaining a normal weight, and they weren't included in here. So I think that's where you'd want to understand this is not truly a random sample, a random cross-section of individuals with cystic fibrosis and how that can have an impact there. And then the second point that I thought would be interesting to talk about is that something that Kim had raised earlier about this A1C. And so there is a bit of an increase there from 5.6 all the way up to 6.1. So it did tend to go up, but definitely not high numbers in these individuals, these likely asymptomatic individuals. So Kim, what are your thoughts in particular, just based on this? This isn't the point of the article, thinking about A1Cs, but they do give us some information about that. So what would your thoughts be about A1Cs and when we should use those in CFRD? Are they helpful? Are they not helpful? So just kind of as an aside, why don't you give us your thoughts on that?
Well, a diagnosis of cystic fibrosis-related diabetes can be made on an elevated hemoglobin A1C using the normal criterion, but you certainly will miss a lot of abnormalities if you use that level. So there has been a push more recently, especially from Canada, I must say, but also from France, to use a lower level, a lower threshold to make the diagnosis. And there's a group pushing to make that at 5.8%. And so if I note that 5.8% is actually the mean for this group of patients. So half of them would fit those criterion for diabetes. And the other way of making a diagnosis is possibly also using continuous glucose monitoring. And if you look at the time outside of range, and there are clinical correlates of that, then some of these may have had diabetes if the CGM was used as the gold standard. There is another suggestion that a cutoff of 5.5 4% could be used, a hemoglobin A1C of 5.4%. And if 5.4% was used as a cutoff to then have an oral glucose tolerance test, that would reduce the number of oral glucose tolerance tests that are currently being recommended.
Obviously, this is outside of what these authors are looking at, but helps us understand that it's actually a lot more complicated. The OGTT has for a long time been the standard way of diagnosing CFRD. But when you start throwing in these other ways of figuring out glucose metabolism, can complicate things a little bit. So thank you for that aside there. So Rich, why don't you go back to the results here and walk us through particularly these different stages based on beta cell function and other aspects of glucose metabolism that the authors identify.
Yeah, so we've gone through their descriptive statistics a little bit. And again, the point out of those was that they had members of each of these pre-specified categories of glucose tolerance. When they actually looked at the beta cell function, they found it declined as one progressed from stage to stage. Although this progression sometimes was seen in only one of their two parameters rather than the other. As you recall, when Chase was going over their methods, one of their measures was the responsiveness to the rise in glucose, sometimes called first phase insulin secretion. Here they called it, they had a different term for it. And the second way they measure that was the response to the actual ambient glucose concentration, which they refer to as the second phase. What they found was both of those measures of insulin secretion were highest in the normal individuals. So they saw a decline as they went across this spectrum. Interestingly, the response to the initial glucose rise, this first phase, fell significantly just by the time they were in this AGT-140 class. That is the earliest sign of glucose intolerance, if you will. It had already fallen by 50% by that group, and it ultimately fell 85% by the time they had cystic fibrosis-related diabetes. The response to the ambient glucose level didn't fall quite as dramatically, fell about 35% in that first group, the AGT-140s, and then by the impaired glucose tolerance had fallen by about 60%, and then fell by 77% in the cystic fibrosis-related diabetes group. So they did see a decline in both their measures of insulin secretion. They saw a little bit of a difference in how that manifested over these classes. That was the largest of their findings. They actually have a very nice graph and a very nice bar graph to sort of illustrate that it looks like a progression from one step to the other. As you look, and what's really most interesting is that there's a big step from the normal glucose tolerance to this AGT-140. So that it seems that glucose tolerance, insulin secretion really falls pretty early on and then across the spectrum. That was probably their main findings. Insulin sensitivity fell by 9 to 15% and had fallen by about 20% by the time they got to the CFRD class. But that was a relatively small set of changes, and they weren't really sure this was that significant. And they didn't see any change in the insulin clearance. So the parameter that stood out of the parameters they were measuring across this spectrum of glucose tolerance was a decline in insulin secretion. And I think that was the main point, and that they felt that the insulin secretion parameters could actually delineate or go along nicely with the preset glucose cutoffs.
Good. Thanks, Rich. So we're going to now move into the discussion. We'll start with the author's conclusion. So we'll go through those and list those and describe them a little bit. But then we're going to follow that with some of our own thoughts, some of them related to the points that the authors make, but then also some additional thoughts beyond that before we wrap things up. So to start with, the author summarized that they come up with their conclusions based on three determinants of glucose assessment, not only the beta cell function, but also insulin clearance and insulin sensitivity. And using those results, they come up with five what they describe as novel results. So the first one that they mention is the point that Rich made, is that even in early stages of abnormal glucose metabolism, that there is significantly worse beta cell function. So something that maybe has not been widely appreciated, but is seen even very early on. The second point that they make is that there is a component of impaired insulin sensitivity, and particularly when you look at the difference between that first abnormal group, the AGT-140, abnormal glucose tolerance 140, and impaired glucose tolerance, that there is a major difference there. And that difference really does seem to be the impaired sensitivity. So just like Rich said, overall, not a huge impact, but looking at some stages does seem to be a major difference. That one we'll come back to and think more about that here in a second. The third point that the authors make about their novel results is that the indeterminate stage actually has numerous characteristics that are identical to the impaired glucose tolerance stage, despite that normal two-hour glucose. So one of them, based on the just a traditional use of the OGTT, one of them, the impaired glucose tolerance, would be labeled as abnormal, where the indeterminate would be described as normal. But really, when you look at these characteristics based on these different components, based on the beta cell function and resistance and clearance, there actually are several characteristics that are no difference between those two groups. The fourth point that they make is that when you look at actually the progression all the way to CFRD, it really does seem to be a decline in that proportional control of the beta cell function. That seems to be that final insult that leads into a diagnosis of CFRD. And then the fifth point that they make, one that Rich highlighted already, is that insulin clearance seems to play a minor role, at least in the results that they obtained here. So these are the five novel results that the authors say that they have identified here. So now what we want to do is to go through some of these and give our own thoughts related to that and other ideas that we have. So one of them is just to go back through what we've talked about already is this idea of progressive stages. And to, again, highlight that just with cross-sectional studies in and of themselves, you can't really tell there's a progression. So just to play a devil's advocate and to come up with a different argument, I would say questions that we don't know from this is that does an individual always progress from one stage to another? Do you always start out with normal and then go to AGT 140 and then go through one right after the other? Or can you skip stages and go all the way to the end? Can you actually regress? So is it possible that you can go forward and then without any other changes, go back and then forward? These things we don't know. So and the authors, I don't think, make too much of a claim. But if we're, as readers, not careful, I think that we can assume that this really proves, because of this almost hierarchy that they've described, that you have to go from one and that happens in an orderly, logical progression. That may happen, and there may be other data that would inform that. But in and of itself, cross-sectional studies are very limited in their ability to tell you that. So that's the first point that I would suggest there. The other point, and this is one that I would like to get Rich and Kim's thoughts on, is the way the authors describe the importance of these intermediate stages. So the authors suggest that adding these mid-OGTT elevations, so the AGT 140 and the indeterminate, making these separate stages, they suggest that may be necessary. That use of the word necessary, and then the authors just suggest that, they say maybe it is, but that's what I want to think about. And why is that necessary? Is it necessary just for understanding the natural history? Or if we're thinking about the clinical implications of these things, do we feel like it's necessary from that perspective? And I guess my main question is, are these going to be actionable findings? So if I do this for my patients and I identify what I would have normally said, oh, this patient's normal at 2 hours, their glucose is under 140, they don't have CFRD. But if I start looking at the midpoint a little more closely and identify that they maybe get above 140 or above 200, what do I do with that? How is that necessary? So Kim and Rich, can you give me your thoughts on that idea?
We don't know the answer to all of those. It's not just the midpoint. I think they make that message that it's the 30, 60 and 90, and it may well be that 30 minutes is really important to that very first phase, which is the one that they, I guess, described predominantly. That's the most novel part. But it does actually support other evidence of a decline in the general health of an individual. There is data already that decline in weight occurs around this time or before this time. There may be an increase in colonization of the lungs with Pseudomonas, with impaired neutrophil activity. We are learning more, and in fact, there is an interventional study of which I'm one of the investigators using insulin in the very early stages. So we don't know, I guess, the early stages.
You know, Chase, as a clinician, what I'm interested in, of course, is why are we making these diagnoses? So, you know, the criteria we use for diabetes are to predict the risk of microvascular disease and to some extent macrovascular disease. In cystic fibrosis-related diabetes, really the criteria were to identify as Kim was mentioning, less healthy individuals, people who were going to get into trouble. And so, you know, I don't think we know right now that these earlier stages are necessarily associated with people who are going to get into trouble. The suggestion, which is a hypothesis to follow, is that they are steps in a progression. As you said, you really don't know that for sure. But they would be then steps in a progression to becoming less healthy, as she mentioned. And that would be, maybe you would target those individuals for more intensive monitoring, et cetera. So that, I think that's where things will turn out. I don't think this set of criteria in cystic fibrosis-related diabetes really is tied very closely yet to microvascular disease. I think it's a very different diagnosis.
Good. I like that way of thinking it. So thinking of, okay, ultimately, what do we need to answer that question? We'll come back to that at the very end. What more data do we want? That's what Kim referenced, studies that are ongoing now. But I do like that idea that Rich has indicated, is we kind of use this to look at, okay, what people are not healthy here. So if I've got concern that maybe I have a patient who is struggling to maintain a normal weight, and even if they only have some intermediate stages there, that could be enough information, knowing that that is abnormal beta cell function, even if it doesn't carry an official diagnosis that we've used before, that maybe marrying those two, at least while we're waiting for more definitive data to understand, that would make sense. Good. And Rich, another question for you. I know this was a question that you had about what other information might have been helpful here, is that you were curious as to what some of the other biochemical, particularly hormonal abnormalities that might be present here, particularly when we think about other hormones that would affect insulin action or secretion. So wondering about glucagon levels, for example. What other information might you have liked to have seen here to understand a little bit more about what's going on in these individuals?
Yeah, I raise this point. The authors make the point that to understand a glucose-insulin relationship, you needed to know the insulin secretion rate, you needed to know the sensitivity, and you needed to know the clearance. But there's also the milieu, which they didn't identify, at least. So cortisol, glucagon, growth hormone. And the reason I think that they might be of interest is one can guess, I don't have data, at least maybe Kim knows data, that there are compensations being made physiologically as things change for the patient with cystic fibrosis that might impact on these data, positively or negatively for that matter. So it just would have been interesting to know if some of these hormonal levels maybe just even at baseline to see if there were profiles within this that looked a little bit different. You could claim that most of those things would have been captured by the insulin sensitivity index, but still they could have also been measured.
Another question that I had, so, and this is looking at the idea of identification of declining beta cell function is the big driver here, but it's not the only driver. Clearance didn't seem to be a big deal, but sensitivity, at least in some of the stages, and the authors highlight this, is that worsening of insulin sensitivity may be part of this progression if it truly progresses along these stages as they've outlined here. So that raised, at least in my mind, so traditionally when we've had folks with CFRD, insulin therapy is pretty much the only thing that we'll use. Maybe in very selected circumstances, we'll think about a secreted GOG based on some newer data that's out there, though that's not traditionally been an approach that we've used. Usually something that we don't do at all is actually targeting insulin sensitivity. So metformin, for example, while very common in type 2 diabetes treatment, would not be a standard approach in CFRD. Does this data call that into question? Do we need to at least be rethinking about use of something, an agent to increase sensitivity, if that is a component of this progression?
Well, it's something to keep an open mind about. There may be some other drugs that would be more suitable than metformin to increase insulin sensitivity. But indeed, in beta cell failure in type 1 diabetes, we also see increase in insulin resistance, and some of those patients can also benefit. They're more suited to metformin therapy. So I don't know that that's so surprising. I guess the surprising thing is that they're not overweight.
Yeah, again, Chase, I think that just comes to the possibility of other hormones. For example, if as health declined, cortisol secretion increased, it could actually modulate the insulin sensitivity, and perhaps that was picked up here.
Good. And one final point, just to touch base on again, it was mentioned already, But as we think about those measurements of beta cell function, I think it is important to realize that they were developed in other populations, primarily not in individuals with CFRD. So we don't know for sure that these calculations work just as well, that this modeling is a good approach to use in folks with CFRD. No reason to think that it's not, but just a potential limitation in applying these methodologies that were developed in other patient populations with somewhat distinct pathophysiology and applying it to this group, as was mentioned already. So as we wrap up things, I want us to think just a little bit more about how this information, this study might change our practice. And so the first question would be is actually asking that. So would this change our practice? So Rich, I think we'll start with you. So based on the information that's presented here, will this change anything that you do right now? Will it reinforce what you do right now? Will it not really make an impact at all? How would you describe that?
No, first I'd have to check. I have to check whether our screening people are actually measuring all these different intermediate stages or just measuring the first and last glucose, because I have a feeling that's really all they've been doing so far. I'm not sure that this study convinces me that we should add all those time points in and the cost, especially for these young individuals to get tested every year from the age of 10 for all these different time points. But if we were getting that data, I do think the data is interesting to sort of pick up that as soon as you start to see abnormalities, you may monitor things more carefully. You may want to pay much more attention to that individual's compliance and nutrition, which would be the big issues we would focus in on. So I see them as perhaps flagging someone who needs more attention. I don't see a bigger intervention than that right now.
I would agree with that. The other thing we haven't really talked about is the nutrition. And we know the diets that are recommended for children and young people with CF are certainly different from the diets we recommend for people with diabetes and healthy diets. And in fact, in Australia, we have a lot of kids who drink a lot of Coca-Cola, and that is thought to be quite helpful in CF because it's a caloric density. So I think really this supports looking again at nutrition as well, what we actually are recommending that people drink and eat.
But one thing I thought that it could have an impact on in a way that I would assess people is the group that Kim had mentioned earlier is when we have somebody with cystic fibrosis, hasn't yet been diagnosed with CFRD, but we're maybe asked by our pulmonary colleagues, is this somebody that we should think about insulin for? So even though we don't have a data to support an approach like this, it may actually help give more information if you were to do an OGTT and then collect some of that intermediate information. So several points along that midpoint, so not just the immediate midpoint, but just as Kim mentioned, 30, 60, 90 minutes, and maybe using that to get a little bit more information to try to understand if an individual has actual abnormal glucose metabolism and perhaps using that to guide a decision on insulin therapy, though again, we don't have any data that would suggest that, but could be helpful when trying to sort out what to do in an unclear clinical situation like that. So where I would like to end is with Kim, something that she referenced earlier, and it's the idea of what more information do we need at this point? So there's always limitations with observational studies, particularly ones that don't have a time component, that are not longitudinal. So Kim, as you as an investigator look at a study like this and can appreciate the strengths of it and what it adds to our information of this disease process, what other things do you think are still needed? What information do we need to know to really be able to confidently change our practice for our patients with CFRD?
Well, we definitely need prospective studies. And this study even could have some retrospective analysis that would give us some better understanding of what they were like before. But we need longitudinal data. There are some animal models, and indeed there's the ferret is a very good model of cystic fibrosis that can give us some idea about what's happening to use this cross-sectional data and try and understand it. But we need longitudinal studies, and we need to know more about the general health, including lung function, not just BMI in this group and these patients.
And with that, I would like to thank Rich Comey and Kim Donahue for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I learned a great deal, as I know you all did, and hope that you will join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of Endocrine Society with special production oversight by Maggie Graham.